21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. This is Talk Radio 680 WCBM. It's time now for award-winning 21st Century Radio. Here's your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Yes, we're not giving up on love, but we should be giving up a lot of the hate that's being espoused by people that really should know better and that like to call themselves Christians. It's unbelievable out there, isn't it, friends? Well, I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus. Our executive producer and research assistant is Laura Cordner, and our engineer is A.Y. Warshaw. Well, in the mid-70s, although I was married, I fell in love with the scholarly work of Dr. Francis Yates, author of many books that are my favorites in the whole wide world. Actually, they're my favoritist. Something like that, yeah. Oh, here's a few titles. The Art of Memory, Theater of the World, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition, The Rosicrucian Enlightenment. You should see my copy of Rosicrucian Enlightenment. No one else can read it but myself. It's written all over. Yeah. Well, every book I've written since then and in the future contains Dame Frances Yates in my bibliographies. Yep, she passed on to the spiritual realms in 1981, but my love for her just grows. However, Dame Yates has been reborn in the form of the book Frances Yates and the Hermetic Tradition by Marjorie G. Jones, who is joining us for the first 1.5 hours tonight. Marjorie G. Jones is a graduate of Wheaton College, Norton, Massachusetts, and the Rutgers School of Law. In the 1990s, after 25 years in banking and executive recruitment, she returned to school and earned an M.A. in historical studies at the graduate faculty of the New School in New York City, where she wrote her thesis about early unpublished writings of Frances Yates. Since then, she has taught history at the New School and Mercy College, Dobbs Ferry, New York. A member of Writing Women's Lives Seminar in New York City, she lives with her husband in Bronxville, New York. And this is her first book, and now Bronxville is where my beloved daughter, Marae Hieronymus, received her Master of Fine Arts from Sarah Lawrence just a few years back. Isn't that some coincidence, friends? If there are coincidences. Could I say that right? Coincidences? Yeah. Welcome to 21st Century Radio, Marjorie. Your book is indeed a godsend.
Oh, how lovely. It's wonderful to be here, Bob. And what a small world that you know Bronxville.
Well, I really love that place, you know, especially my daughter. I had such a great time up there. That little town has one of the nicest coffee shops I've ever been in.
Yes, it does. It's lovely. And we live right down the hill from Sarah Lawrence, so I know we spend a lot of time there.
Well, it's a beautiful neighborhood. It really is. You have some wonderful, the whole area, it just feels like, I do believe Joseph Campbell spent some time up there, did he, dear?
Yes, he actually did. He taught for many years at Sarah Lawrence. And interestingly, speaking of coincidences or small worlds, Campbell's Hero with the Thousand Faces is one of the books that led me to Frances Yates.
Well, I'll be. Oh, wow. Well, tell us, who was Frances Yates?
Frances Yates was a prominent British historian who was born in 1899 and, as you mentioned, died in 1981. And almost single-handedly, I think, transformed Renaissance historiography because she said that unlike the history that most of us learned when we were growing up, the history of the Renaissance was that the history of the Renaissance was all about humanism and secularism.
Mm-hmm.
Frances Yates said, no, 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 much more was going on during the Renaissance, and revealed this strong strain of mysticism that she called the Hermetic tradition that came down from the Middle Ages and was still very prominent and influential in Renaissance thought. And after she wrote her great book, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition, which was published in 62 or 63, really Renaissance history was never the same again, although she was roundly, through the years, soundly criticized for her historiography. One of her proponents said that any future historian would ignore her work at her or his peril. So she was a very influential historian, I think. And her work, as apparently it did to you, spoke to me personally. And I think it's still relevant to perhaps even more than ever in this fractured world we live in today.
More than ever. You're absolutely right. Now, as you know, Dame Yates always sought to uncover a different, richer kind of history. I'm quoting you, of course, dear. The forgotten history. She explored the history of hope. Could you tell us a little bit about that perspective, dear?
Yes. She talked about history in the round, or the history of hope, and she was always interested also in the what-ifs of history, mm-hmm. which fascinate me as well, about what if things had happened, gone just a different way? What was the alternative, and what else was out there that we didn't learn about in recorded history? For example, what if Henri the Fourth of France hadn't been assassinated by a Catholic fanatic in 1610? He was a great figure of reconciliation in France. And she was looking at what she thought were valid aspects of history that often were ignored, times in history when it just could have gone another way. Mm-hmm. And subsequent history would have been much more peaceful or loving. And that's what I think she meant by the history of hope, that to look at not just the political events, but just, actually, I give my students that assignment at the beginning, my historiography students, at the beginning of every semester, to write something about the what if of history. One of my favorites, for example, is what if Victoria, the daughter of Queen Victoria, and her husband had, who was sick by the time he took the German throne, had lived longer, could World War One have been prevented? And I think that an argument can be made there. So that was the kind of history she was interested in. I mean, she knew she knew the stuff that the rest of us all learned, but she had a really fertile imagination and a wonderfully creative imagination that I think came about because she was not conventionally educated.
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed. That happens an awful lot with so many geniuses on this planet. So would you say that's why she's so important?
Why?
Or does it go beyond that? That is, looking at history from the perspective of a three-dimensional history, as you noted there, or what-if history, because American history is the same way. It's just recently that we've been able to uncover the possibility that the fact, actually, that many of the founding fathers were members of certain types of secret societies and that they did influence our symbolism and our nation. But that had been ignored, oh, goodness gracious, I don't know how, well, from the beginning it's been ignored until the last 20 or 30 years.
Well, I would turn it around. What difference does it make?
Well, it does make a difference, especially in regards to understanding why Benjamin Franklin did what he did, especially with France, how he raised the money.
Yeah.
And amongst his brethren of the four or five different societies, the Freemasonic societies he was involved in. And, of course, that made a very big difference in our being able to pay for part of the revolution and getting France to help us, along with the armies that he brought over. It was a much more personal thing than most historians ever looked at.
Uh-huh.
They usually not just criticize it, but say that it was totally unimportant. It wasn't.
Yeah.
George Washington, especially to George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Paul Revere and so many of the other of the founding fathers. But, I mean, it wasn't the only thing. I mean, it was the only input, because we've just now beginning to filter down for the lessons about 1990, the League of the Iroquois influence upon some of the founding fathers.
We know nothing about indigenous history. We know nothing about women's history. We're just beginning to learn about African American history. I mean, we were taught in Europe as well until recently, but certainly we were taught white man's history. Mm-hmm. And I think among the reasons I like her is that she was conveying a much richer history.
Mm-hmm. Well, is that the reason why she interested you?
My interest in Frances Yates really came about from my own spiritual journey. I'm always read a lot, and I'm what's known in the trade as a recovering lawyer. And I began to get very restless intellectually in my 40s and thought about going back to school. And a couple of books that I read, including Bruno, her Bruno, and Campbell's, as I mentioned, Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces, and also a really superb biography, I don't know if you know it, is Octavio Paz's biography of Sor Juana de la Cruz, the Mexican mystic, who is just a fascinating woman. And Paz also mentioned Yates, so I began to fool, without realizing where I was going, where my own reading took me, her name kept coming up. And somewhere along the way in my 40s, I decided that I'd like to go back to school. And although I was working and my daughter was in college, I applied to the graduate faculty of the New School. And I didn't have to take the GMATs or anything, thank God. And I was accepted. And I was accepted into their historical studies program, which is an interdisciplinary program. And one of our first assignments, of course, I was terrified. I thought, sitting bolt upright one night in the middle of the night saying, oh, my God, I can't write a paper. I don't know how to do that anymore. And I had the most wonderful professor from Germany, Berlin, who said to me, oh, Mrs. Jones, don't worry. Historians get better as they get older, which was just the perfect thing to say. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it was just perfect. One of my professors was Eric Hobsbawm, renowned British professor. Mm-hmm. And one of our earliest assignments was to write a paper about the body of work of any given historian. So I went to see Professor Hobsbawm, and I said, you know, just what I've just said to you. You know, I've been reading a lot about this woman named Frances Yates. And Hobsbawm's eyes lit up, and he said, oh, well, then you have to go to the Warburg Institute. And I said, what's the Warburg Institute? And he explained it to me. And interestingly, as I said in my book, here's another coincidence, the first time in the late 30s that Frances Yates met someone from the Warburg Institute who had her book in his hand, she said to him, what's the Warburg Institute? The exact same question that I asked Eric Hobsbawm. So one thing led to another. I wrote a paper. I think I got a pretty good grade on it. And my husband and I had a yard sale to pay for my trip and that summer. And I took myself off to London. I wrote you have to apply to get into the Warburg Institute. And I took myself off to London to the Warburg Institute. Have you ever visited the Warburg?
No, I haven't, but maybe I wish you would tell us a little bit more about the Warburg
Institute.
It's just
a wonderful place. It's really like stepping back in time. I call it kind of Dickensian, but when I was first there, it must have been around, I'm thinking, 1995, maybe even earlier, there were still pull-string lights and dark, dark stacks. It was great, and I mean, just the most wonderful quintessential, at least for an American, to an American, quintessential English types walking around. It was just terrific. And once you get a reader's card, which I got, it was easy. I mean, because I had been invited to come, you can just go to the stacks and take books from the 15 and 1600s off the stacks. I mean, it's just extraordinary. So I met with Yates's literary executor, a very crusty, he's since died, a very crusty chap named Joseph Trapp, who quite frankly was disdainful and not terribly pleasant. And I think it's because I represented his worst nightmare. I mean, I am an American. I am a woman. I mean, I don't
two
know
strikes against you, dear.
Really, I don't know which of those is worse. And I at the time, I don't know if I am now, but at the time I wasn't a scholar. So he just was just terribly impatient with me. But I must have gone back for at least 10 years, 10 summers and sometimes in between. And I discovered that he was crusty and impossible with everyone. So I learned not to take it personally. And I was writing, I know what I was writing about. The topic of my paper was the tarot cards, because they interest me as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of the first 21 cards being an illustration of the internal journey, the internal spiritual journey.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you're aware, but one of the last articles that Francis Yates wrote for the New York Review of Books was about the tarot.
Yeah, I think you mentioned that in your book, dear.
I do, yeah. I wanted to learn about the tarot, and the Warburg, of course, has a lot about the tarot. About the second or third day I was there, he said to me, you know, there are two trunks of family papers in the basement. Do you want to see them? And I said, sure. I mean, why not?
My
you know,
God, yeah.
I mean, go as the kids would say now, go for it, you know. Mm-hmm. So these two trunks came, I mean, massive trunks came up to the basement, and they were just smelly with mildew and in complete disarray. And there was the history of the Yates family that no one had ever looked at, even no one at the Warburg. This was 95, and she had died in 81. And I began to go through these trunks, and my Lord, it was just a stunning experience.
Oh, what a journey.
Oh, really? Mm. And I found her diaries, and I found unpublished novels. Had very interesting family, and I found family photos, and I found all her brother's correspondence from World War One. I mean, it was overwhelming. So I don't remember the exact sequence of events, but by the time it came to write my thesis, a year or two later, must have been it was 4 or 5 years later, because it took me 5 to 6 years to complete my master's degree because the graduate faculty let me pursue it one course at a time. So when I came to write my thesis, as you mentioned, I wrote on the early unpublished works of Frances Yates, and I found her, I mean, who am I? I found her master's thesis that I don't think anybody had ever read.
Isn't that amazing?
I found an aborted translation of the Ash Wednesday Supper that I think had been forgotten.
Oh, my.
I forget what the third, offhand, I can't remember what the third piece I wrote about. Maybe her diary. Oh, I know what I found. Probably the most important thing. And, gee, we should all campaign to get this published. I found a remarkable, stunning wartime journal she wrote in 1916 when she was 16.
Mm.
And it was in the trunk, and it hadn't been copied or protected in any way. And I write about it in my book. It was really, I think it's really an important document. And I've urged the Warburg, first of all, I've urged them to make a photocopy. And secondly, it should be published on its own. It could stand on its own as one of her works.
Well,
so I wrote my thesis, and I got my degree, and I began teaching. And frankly, I said, one of my colleagues that I teach at Mercy read it and said, you really should go on with this. And I said, but I really don't want to get abused anymore.
Abused?
By her executor.
Oh, yes.
You know,
yes.
I had a teaching job, and then he died.
Oh,
and,
my.
I began to go back again, at the risk of sounding very cruel and callous. I began to go back again, and it took me 10 years or so to accumulate the biography. And the new director of the Warburg looked at me one day and said, well, backhanded compliment. He said, somebody has to write it, and it might as well be you. I mean, really.
I'm sorry.
And, you know, I was a big girl by then. I mean, I was well into my 50s, and I thought,
might as well be you.
Who needs this, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, I wrote it, and took a while, and then I shopped it around because I used to be a headhunter, and I headhunted a publisher, and I found Ibis Press, a wonderful press.
Oh, gosh, yes. They've done some
and they
great
picked
books.
It up right away. You know, I mean, I got lots of rejections, but Ivan Palya picked it up right away, which was just, I mean, a gift. I mean, really the among the greatest gifts I've ever received. And finally it was published 2 years ago. It's a very long story.
Well, when we return, because we've got to take our first break, we're going to talk about the Hermetic tradition and Bruno himself.
Good.
But I want to first get to something that you note on page 66. As was customary, most of the female scholars were identified only by their first initials.
Sure.
Perhaps to disguise the fact that they were women.
Not perhaps. Huh? I would write that differently now.
We know for sure, right?
Yeah.
But which may have diminished their chances for recognition, of course, and publication. And that is a shocking. It may be normal for the rest of the world, but women have had to tolerate this kind of stuff forever.
Yep.
Women are the future of this planet. Without them, we're in deep doo-doo. Because
yeah.
If not, we are going to go through one war after another. Men just don't seem to have their act together. Sorry,
everybody says the way to improve the world, the most effective way to fix things, is to educate your girls.
Well, they're right. They're right.
Yep.
And in the future, they will have their chance, because it certainly has been smothered over the last couple of centuries. But that'll change. Wait, we're going to take our first break here on 21st Century Radio. Marjorie G. Jones, Francis Yates, and the Hermetic Tradition, Ibis Press. Order it from the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or visit Marjorie's page at Marjorie, MarjorieGJones.com. If you're a business owner or executive seeking growth yet determined to cut wasteful costs, consider outsourcing your whole marketing department to The Selling Well. The Selling Well offers businesses truly superior marketing services without all the overhead costs associated with employing a full-time marketing executive. Learn more online at theSellingWell.com. That's theSellingWell.com, named after one of our greatest symbols of prosperity, the well. Visit theSellingWell.com or call The Selling Well's managing partner, Plato Hieronymus, at 443-939-1890, theSellingWell.com. Orioles magic? Well, let's make it happen. O-R-I-O-L-E-S. Now, here's what I want you to do, friends. Take three deep breaths and then repeat after me. 39, 19, 76, 37. Play them box and straight, or just watch the lottery and see these numbers coming in. Concentrate on 39, 19, and 76, 37. These are the longitude and latitude coordinates for Baltimore, and we are trying to energize our Oriole birds by sending them concentrated magic energy of directed thought. If enough of us do this, the lottery numbers might just reflect it, and better still, the Orioles' win column might also begin to increase. So all together now, 39, 19, 76, 37, 39, 19, 76, 37. 39, 19, 76, 37.
Hello, I'm Dean Radin, author of Entangled Minds, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Thank you, Dean. Hey, the Orioles win column has increased, but I don't necessarily think it's because of our experiment. We got a new manager, and he certainly has made a difference. Well, our guest is Marjorie G. Jones, Francis Yates, and the Hermetic Tradition, Ibis Press. Order it from the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or visit Marjorie's page at MarjorieGJones.com. Okay, Marjorie, what is the Hermetic Tradition?
When people ask me that, I can say I have a definition that is as succinct as I can come up with. And it is that the Hermetic tradition is an ancient philosophy that is a synthesis or blend of mysticism, Gnosticism, and magic. Now, when we hear magic in our society, we think, oh, hocus pocus or something that makes us uncomfortable, like the word pagan tends to make us uncomfortable. But magic in the 15 and 1600s was really a precursor of modern-day science. It also had to do with the idea of transformation, physical transformation that could be a metaphor for spiritual transformation. For example, an easy example is hard boiling an egg or freezing water. What happens in some kind of process through heat or cold is that the substance is transformed. And when I think of magic from the Renaissance, or even now, I mean, that's what I think of. People who are interested in magic, it wasn't separate from mysticism, it wasn't apart from mysticism, were interested in what was going on. You know, we hear a lot about people looking to transform gold and all that stuff, but the real serious mystics and magicians, a medieval magus, for example, was really looking, I think, for spiritual transformation or how we are transformed or substances are transformed and what that means to our lives. So if you put that together with mysticism and Gnosticism, which is the inward journey, which is what I think all religions are about, even though they get caught up in these terrible finalities and absolutisms that just distort all, this is my opinion, distort all religions, that philosophy is personally very appealing to me, and I think it was to Francis Yates, and I certainly think it was to Giordano Bruno.
Oh, yes.
Who was, as you know, a Catholic priest, an itinerant Catholic priest from Italy, who in the late 1500s, when all kinds of interesting things religiously and spiritually are happening in Europe, traveled through Europe, into the courts of Europe, preaching this mysterious doctrine that Yates, I don't think, to the best of my knowledge, Giordano Bruno never said, "I am a hermeticist," but Yates labeled it the hermetic tradition. And that was when she had her epiphany regarding what he was talking about. He went wandered all through the courts and ended up in England, in the court of Elizabeth I, which is a really interesting place. And before, for reasons that I still cannot decipher, before he went back to Italy, where he was grilled and tortured by the Inquisition, until he was finally martyred at the Campo dei Fiori, burned in 1600. But what he was preaching, I believe, and what I read Frances Yates, was that there was a way to solve these religious conflicts, which, of course, the conflicts at the time were between Protestantism and Catholicism, and that this philosophy, this strain of spirituality that came down from the Middle Ages could provide one of the answers, because you could have and can have mystic Christians, you could have mystic Jews, you can have mystic Muslims. And at a certain level, as Campbell also said in his book, A Hero with a Thousand Faces, all religions are about the same thing. They're That's about right. the mm-hmm. inward journey, and we get caught up in the metaphors instead of what the experience is supposed to be. So I think That's because of my readings of Frances Yates, that's what she thought Bruno was preaching.
Mm-hmm.
And she labeled it the hermetic tradition. And I think it was opened a whole new window into Renaissance thought that this was going on. And because she was at the Warburg, where iconography and other kinds of art and literature and music were studied as context for history, she and the other Warburgians began to see this trend everywhere, to see this influence everywhere throughout Europe. And I think she was accused often by her later critics of seeing hermeticism everywhere, but I think it is everywhere.
Well, it is, of course. Yes, it is.
Yeah, and so Bruno, in the end, I'm pretty sure it's in my book, she became convinced that Bruno was no longer a Christian, that he had trouble with the idea of the Trinity, and he no longer, or if he ever did, conformed to strict church doctrine, which, of course, by the late 1500s is probably the way it is today, but was really, really serious business. I mean, any deviance from church doctrine was serious, and she questioned whether he was a traditional Christian. And the great, you probably know, of course, the great story about Bruno is they burned him, I think, with green wood, so it would take longer, and held, as he was burning, held a crucifix up to his lips, and he turned away. Because I think he was a visionary, and I think given the times that Frances Yates grew up in, her family was horribly scarred during the war by the death of the only son, which was really awful. Mm-hmm. I think she saw this as some kind of salve or salvation for Europe, which in the 16th century, and also, of course, in her own century, the 20th, which Europe was tearing itself apart. And I think its salvation, its potential salvation in our century, when it's incredible to me. We seem to be engaged in this terrible, horrific chapter of religious warfare.
We certainly are, and a great deal of it has to do with ignorance. One of the things I think that Thomas Jefferson did write was what is now called the Thomas Jefferson Bible, in which
he took
the Bible and cut out. It took him, 16 years to do this, cut out only what Jesus said.
Right.
He did not want someone else's interpretation. And that's what we're filled with today. We're filled with everybody's interpretations of what Jesus said or did. And they're not acting in accordance to what Jesus was talking about. The compassion that Christians are supposed to have, and the caring nature of it. I better get out of the way here. That's not what we're talking about here.
That's all right. But I think what you're talking about is, I live in New York. I mean, we're going through this absurd and I think obscene debate about whether there should be a mosque two blocks away from the World Trade Center. Well, as my husband said, let's build the mosque right on the World Trade Center site. I mean, what could be a better statement of who we are? And, if the mosque is two blocks away, boy, you're going to get calls on this, I suppose. If the mosque is two blocks away or three blocks away or four blocks away, last I checked, according to Jefferson, we were, the church and state were supposed to be separate. And
supposed
to be a tolerant country. And to me, that's why the Hermetic tradition is still very, very relevant. Because I personally believe, my spiritual journey has to do with my inward journey. And if I enjoy or appreciate or practice any of the rituals or metaphors of another religion, it's to enhance my spiritual journey.
My
inner journey. So mm-hmm. Hermeticism, again, going back to where I started, this blend of mysticism, which all religions have, that I know about, mysticism, Gnosticism, and magic, which doesn't mean what we think it does now.
No, it doesn't. But, one of the things that most people do not realize, and this is really going to break a lot of people's hearts out there who listen to this station and other Fox stations, is that Murdoch is supporting economically this building in New York City dealing with this is what is amazing to me.
I don't follow Murdoch.
Oh, well, he is the owner of Fox.
I know who he is.
I'm
not an advocate of a follower of Murdoch.
Well, maybe not, but he is certainly in support of what you were saying.
Yeah, I mean,
but the ignorance of most other people who have looked into this. They haven't even looked at the aspect of who was behind him. Where is the money coming from? But that's another story. Now,
yes.
So there's always when you fundamentalism can truly crush spirit, regardless of what religion it's in.
Yeah, well, I read recently, because I have no original thoughts of my own, but I read recently that the tensions aren't necessarily coming right now between among Christians, Muslims, and Jews. The tensions worldwide, and this makes sense to me, are coming between fundamentalists and more enlightened people in any religion, and that makes sense to me. It doesn't solve the problem, but it makes sense to me. And I think when people are afraid or economic times are bad, they like religions that give them, seem to provide definite answers. I mean, I say to my students, and in this way it's interesting, I think it's interesting, that law and history work very well together. Because the first week in law school, I remember one of our professors said, so what's the answer to every question? Yeah, we all looked at him. And he said, well, of course, the answer to every question is, it depends. Isn't that great? Looking who's asking. So I say to my students, because I have students, especially, I didn't provide that information, but I teach students at Sing Sing Prison, which is near here. And often I'll have, and the men are wonderfully well-read and wonderfully engaged. But especially up there, they tend often to be religious. God knows, I don't know how else you'd get through that experience. And it's not unusual for one of the men to say to me, but it says in the Bible, or it says in the Quran, Professor, it says right here. And I always say, I have no intention of being disrespectful of your religious beliefs, which I do not tend to be disrespectful. But it says to you that in the Bible, and it says to you that in the Quran, but maybe to me it doesn't say the same thing. So that's why I think law and history work very well together. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the kind of history Francis Yates was trying to convey, that the what-ifs or the history of hope or another way to look at it, and that's troubling for some people. I mean, I've gotten into terrible fights with people. And I'll say it here, mostly men who like history and have very fixed ideas of history. And I've been at parties or in social occasions where I teach history, and some man holds forth on his theory of history. And I remember once recently I said, really almost in innocence, not quite in all innocence, I said, well, you know, there's another way to look at that. And this guy just exploded at me. And he said, oh, I hope you're not one of those people who editorializes history. And I realized I wasn't going to engage with him. But getting back to the Hermetic tradition, I think Bruno and Yates were saying that there's a way beyond all this terrible conflict.
Indeed, and
there's a way for the religions, all the religions of the world, to communicate with one another and to relate to one another, because aren't we all on the same journey? That's a question, a rhetorical question.
No, we certainly are, and it's not necessary to stand around and yell at each other if you want to call that communication, as we have so much in our media today, and more or less has certainly altered the way people treat each other today. We're seeing it all the time. But we need to take a break here. Marjorie G. Jones, Francis Yates, and the Hermetic Tradition, Ibis Press. Order it from the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com. Next week on 21st Century Radio, what happens after you die? Trailblazer Dr. Raymond Moody will be our guest to talk about life after life and the scientific evidence that proves consciousness lives on after the body dies. Sunday night at 8, 21st Century Radio, Talk Radio 680 WCBM. You know, meditation is good for your health, but you just can't figure out how to do it on your own? Time for Meditation 101, free and open to everyone, led by Paul and Bernadette Trattner on the fourth Wednesday of every month from 7 to 8 p.m. in the Cold Spring Newtown. Call 410-664-6240 for directions and questions. Anyone can practice meditation. It's simple and requires no special equipment, and you can practice meditation wherever you are. Manage your stress, increase your self-awareness, and reduce negative emotions. Everyone is welcome to this free class in basic Western meditation techniques. Call 410-664-6240. That's 410-664-6240. Rusco Mansion also offers free meditation sessions every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Call 410-367-7300 for more information. That's 410-367-7300. Whoa, looks like I'm in a former incarnation here. Yes, I am, over there in the dance band there. Fine, free books and prizes just for paying attention. Here's what you can win from 21st Century Radio's quiz: the book Francis Yates and the Hermetic Tradition by Marjorie G. Jones, Ibis Press, www.ibispress.net. Plus, a whole lot more. Wow, yeah, 12 or 13 other books and periodicals, and a punch in the nose just for being nice. So be the first person to answer this simple question, and you're going to win that library of books. Who was our guest on 21st Century Radio last week? You tell us the name of our guest on 21st Century Radio last week, and you're going to be our winner, but you need to qualify. You can either send me $15,000. Yes, the price has gone up. It used to be $10,000 for a bribe, but right now we're in the $15,000 range, and you can do that, or you can do this. If you know the answer to this hour's quiz question on 21st Century Radio and you have not won from us in the last 60 days, call in now. 410-922-6680. That's 410-WCBM-680. First with the right answer wins. Prizes are available for you to pick up at the WCBM studios in Pikesville after Friday of this week. Winners have 60 days to pick up the prizes and must wait 60 days before winning another prize from 21st Century Radio. Good luck.
This is Ed Storms. I'm a researcher in cold fusion, and I'm participating in an interview with 21st Century Radio and Bob Hieronymus.
Hey, Dr. Storm. Yeah, well, the rest of the world, not in America, usual, but the rest of the world has recognized, they don't call it cold fusion anymore, but it is modern alchemy, that's for sure, and the rest of the world's just going to move right ahead of us. Look out for China. They got hold of it. And, of course, our guest is Marjorie G. Jones, Francis Yates in the Hermetic Tradition, Ibis Press. Order it from the front page at 21stcenturyradio.com. The Warburg Institute. I knew very little about it until I read this book. Please tell us about its purpose and its modus operandi and what role it played in Francis's scholarship.
Yes, it's a very interesting story. It was founded in the early years of the 20th century in Germany by Abbe or Abraham Warburg, who was the oldest son of the prominent banking family. And in fact, there's a new substantial biography out of, I think it's Simon Warburg, the next oldest son. But anyway, just came out. Abbe Warburg it was the tradition that the oldest son would take over the banking interests. And Abbe Warburg was a thinker and a reader and wasn't interested in the family business. So the story goes that he exchanged with this brother about whom the new biography has been written, that he exchanged his birthright for all the books he could buy and read.
Oh, my.
And that became the basis of the Warburg Institute in Germany. And he was very interested, Abbe, was very interested in Renaissance iconography for many of the same reasons that we've touched on here, mm-hmm. because he thought a lot more than people realized was going on in Renaissance iconography. And he started this library, this great collection in Hamburg. And then as we get, of course, to the Nazi years, books, the kind of books that, any books, but the books that Warburg was collecting were suspicious to the Nazis. And really, a few steps ahead of the Nazis, the entire collection was shipped to London. This is after Warburg's death. And it was taken, arrived in London in the late 30s. I forget where the original location was. It's not where it is now, on Woburn Square. And it was this group of scholars, this is before Yeats joined, this group of scholars, a lot of the German emigre scholars, were associated with the library, and they had no place else to go at the time. And this incredible collection of rare, really rare, thousands and thousands of rare books became established in London. And an intellectual community was formed around the library. Now, Yeats had been an independent scholar. She didn't go to Oxbridge, and she finally got her degree very late from the University of London as a day student, and began, there's a tradition that I talk about in my book of independent women scholars, began to work as an independent woman scholar. She lived at home with her family, which at that point had, she had, there were three sisters, and the family had been shattered by the death of this only son. Their hopes at all, as with so many other English families, their hopes were all focused on the son. And she began her life of scholarship. She did teach for a while French at a secondary school, and it really almost really amuses me to think of Frances dealing with high school girls. She was so smart. But she began to study, and her first book and articles were about John Florio, who was another Italian in the Renaissance court of Elizabeth I. And it was her first book, John Florio. And I found out when I was researching my book, when I was doing the work for my book, and this gave me such great pleasure, that Frances Yates had to help finance the publishing of her first book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I didn't have to do that because of Ivis Press. that gave me really terrible vicarious pleasure. Anyway, the book made quite an impression, and as a result, she was invited to join the staff of the Warburg as to polish up the English of the German scholars. And as she said, their English often was better than hers. I don't believe it. But they were doing the kind of, her kind of historiography, which was still evolving, was a perfect fit for the kind of thinking that was going on at the Warburg. And she was with them for 40 years until the end of her career.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this history in the round, where context was so important, and what was going on around works of art, and what the work, how the works of art were conveying the political and religious forces that were going on around them. And for example, she and other Warburgians were often criticized by the lit crits, in literary criticism, because she especially insisted if you were going to write about Shakespeare, then you had to, this is very Warburgian, you had to take an account, for example, in The Tempest, his last and my favorite play, you had to take an account what was going on in England and Europe at the time The Tempest was written. And it was written for the wedding ceremony of the daughter of James I, who was named Elizabeth and who married Frederick of Palatine and went off into the Palatine to found this great hermetic court, this court that was just oozing with mysticism and Gnosticism and magic. And Francis and the other Warburgians would say, now, unless you understand some of this underlying history, your literary criticism is meaningless. And, of course, she got in a lot of trouble for that.
Well, we're going to get a lot of trouble if we don't stop right here and continue next hour. We're at the top of the hour with our guest, Marjorie G. Jones, Frances Yates, and the Hermetic Tradition, Ibis Press. Order it from the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com.
Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
A yoga-like meditation practice, first presented by the Theosophist Jeffrey Hodson, is being offered at the Ruscomb Mansion. The purpose of the meditation is to align oneself with the spiritual self in each of us, and then with the divine self in all. First and third Thursdays at 7 p.m. in the meditation room at the Ruscomb Mansion, led by Cheryl Glenn Husk, one of the founding members of Savitria. Call 410-367-7300. For more information, send an email to wellness@ruscomb.org. That number again is 410-367-7300.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kinda yellow, you know it's true, it's so hard to figure what it's all about
when you're outside's in.
Oh, there they are, the Traveling Wilburys, telling us about our outsides being in and our insides being out. And, of course, you know what's going on with the weather. You can see what's going on the planet. Get it? Inside and out. Welcome back to 21st Century Radio. I'm Dr. Bob Hieronymus, our executive producer and research assistant, Laura Cordner. Our engineer is A.Y. Warshaw. And our guest for the next 20-some minutes is Marjorie G. Jones. We've been discussing Francis Yates and the Hermetic Tradition by Ibis Press. And Francis Yates happens to be one of my most favoritist souls, humans, whatever you like to refer to her as, in my entire life. She's really made an enormous impression on me. And I'm certain that she's made even greater impressions on other individuals that have done this research, especially in regards to the quality of her research. Now, Yates's interpretation of Bruno challenged, if not shattered, long-standing conventional interpretations of the unorthodox priest who was burned at the stake by the Inquisition at, I think it was at 1600. Yeah, 1600 in Rome. How did she challenge and shatter it?
Well, still today, a lot of people, Bruno, if they've heard of Bruno, and he's fairly well known. But by the way, I don't know if you've seen it. I'm interrupting myself here, but there's a wonderful looming statue of Bruno in the Campo dei Fiori that was erected in the late 1890s, I think. It's worth a trip.
Okay.
Anyway, when I saw it first, I burst into tears and laid a flower at his feet. But if we hear about Bruno today, we're told conventionally that he was burned, martyred, because he was a champion of the Copernican Revolution, as you know, the idea that the sun and not the earth was at the center of the universe. And it wasn't, by the way, I think until the 1990s that the Vatican recognized that in fact, the earth was not officially recognized that the earth was not at the center of the universe. But Yates said, and this is how she profoundly challenged conventional scholarship. I mean, when she wrote the book 40, almost 50 years ago, Yates said, no, no, no. That's not why Bruno was sacrificed, martyred. Bruno was martyred because he was preaching this tradition, this idea of reconciliation that surpassed, transcended any fixed creed. And she said, that's really what got under the skin of the Inquisition. So she was challenging what anyone thought about Bruno and the clash between the Renaissance and the Scientific Revolution, as it was taught in schools throughout England, certainly America, and probably on the continent as well. And conventional scholars didn't like that, and a lot of them disdained her thinking that she was loopy or it was too far-fetched, and that's why, as I said earlier, her literary executors said historians ignore her at their peril, because it's so much neater, and I think a lot of historians like neat history. It's so much neater and easier. You were talking about quick fixes and quick answers. To say yes, he was burned because he championed Copernicus, and she said that wasn't the case.
Well, it certainly wasn't the case, and she certainly proved that. Is there still this antagonism towards her work? I mean, this is 2010.
I think she's still controversial, but there's a lot of. I mean, there's seminars always about her work, and I think she's perhaps less controversial now. But as I said, she was the phrase, she was accused of seeing hermeticism everywhere, and I think a lot of the tension came between literary critics and her brand of history,
mm-hmm.
because she was tough on the literary critics if they did not take the historical context into account. So I think perhaps she's more accepted now, and or her worldview has become accepted to the point that people don't question it and just say, yeah, perhaps there was something else going on in history at the time. But a lot of people don't want to hear about the kind of history that goes beyond politics or war or things like that. They don't. That's why I had such a great experience at the New School, because we talked about cultural anthropology and sociology and psychology and economics in conjunction with history. It was interdisciplinary history, and that's a really succinct way, I think, to describe Warburgian history. It's interdisciplinary,
mm-hmm.
and to my mind, it's much more interesting and much more palatable. And so, if she's known and not criticized as much, it's because perhaps historians are becoming more rounded, like Warburgians.
Or as Thomas Kuhn said, the guys that believe the other stuff die off.
Yeah.
And that seems to be mainly how change takes place. And that I remember the first time I read The Scientific Revolutions, I thought to myself, oh, no. Oh, this is me.
Yeah. No. You know, I've been getting ready for class in the fall, and I've been just making an informal collection of different kinds of history. It's just wonderful. I mean, I found some lately the history of the fortune cookie someone's written about. I mean, you might think, oh, that's ridiculous, but it isn't. I looked at this book, and it tells a lot about the experience of the Chinese Americans. I mean, and now history, I think, is so much more interesting. I mean, there's a history of everything now, and I think she'd applaud that. I would never dare speak for Frances Yates, more about me, but I wonder what she'd think about this American writing her life story. And I hope it's the first of more biographies, by the way. I wanted to try to alert people that there's so much more there. Her correspondence is massive. And this was really just my humble way of saying, please pay more attention to her, because in case you haven't realized it, I'm really fervently, passionately interested in women's history and trying to learn more about women's contributions and women's historians. And often they weren't taken into account because, especially before the 1900s, they weren't allowed to go to the universities. So they had to be independent scholars.
Yes, that's right.
And therefore, I think they were more creative and imaginative scholars. And also, Yates, as I tell the story in my book, was largely educated at home by her mother. And she writes, I think it's the first quote in my book, "It was a marvelous good fortune that can befall no child today." Because I love this. I mean, I'm so envious. Her mother taught her to write by allowing her to read great novels.
I can't think of
a better way to go to school.
Yeah.
And because of that, she could use her historical imagination. Now, if she had been male, she would have been sent away to boarding school as her brother was. But because she was female, it was okay to keep her at home. And also because I think if she had gone to Oxbridge, as one of her sisters did, Hannah, very interesting woman, very, very interesting woman. And Hannah encouraged Frances to try to get into Cambridge, Girton, which is the earliest school at Cambridge. And Frances sat for, it's hard to believe because she was so brilliant, Frances sat for the exams and failed them because she was too busy reading novels. Mm-hmm. But if she had been conventionally educated, I maintain that she would not have been able to see Bruno or this Renaissance history in a different way.
Well, I agree with you. And from my own personal experience, I did not want to become an historian. I did not want to focus 40 years of my life on America's symbols and consciousness, etc. I wanted to just become, to stay an artist. But unfortunately, after I saw what this meant, and especially having read the work of Campbell and Maslow and so many others, you get to the point where, you know, I'm on this planet for a specific reason, many reasons, obviously, and one of them is to lay the foundation for what our founding fathers had told us a long time ago about separation of church and state, which is really key to any republic. Without it, you're going to have a monarchy. We almost had a monarchy in this country in that election of 1799 to 1800, that 1800 election, which almost, we almost lost it.
Well, don't forget the founding mothers.
Of course, and that's where, especially where, I look at it from the League of the Iroquois perspective because without the founding mothers there, the chiefs couldn't be elected, and their methods of their whole social and government was based on the women. Matriarchal society.
Matriarchal, yeah. Well, I mean, to get a bit off the topic, the woman I'm writing about now, I've been doing a lot of, looking a lot of Indian history, because the woman I'm writing about now, Mary Vaux Walcott, an American Quaker, and it's the spiritual journeys of these women that interest me, was a member of the Bureau of Indian Commissions and visited a lot of reservations, but took with her a very patriarchal Christian worldview. Of course, how could we expect her not to? Mm-hmm. But it's made me realize, I mean, the terrible misdeeds, that's a kind word, that were done to the indigenous Americans when we tried to assimilate and Christianize them. Because they're, as you say, they were matriarchal, and they're, they didn't all have the same religion, but it was very hermetic, this idea that spirituality is tied to nature and is cyclical as apart from a linear patriarchal worldview. And that is very appealing to me because if a spirituality or faith is tied to nature, by definition, it's dualistic, and by definition, the female is as important as the male. So I think, I don't know, Frances Yates was not a feminist, by the way. But to me, that's one reason the Hermetic tradition speaks to me.
Well, there are also her moral qualities. What were the moral qualities of her personality, qualities which most surely figure prominently in any future study of her life and work? What were they?
I think integrity, intellectual integrity, which I admire enormously. Mm-hmm. I think she was steadfast. She battled depression, and I admire her steadfastness in the face of that. I admired, as I said earlier, I loved her intellectual courage. I mean, she went places where few people, I mean, at the time, dared to go. I mean, she was way out there, and I love that. I loved her. She had a vibrant, creative imagination. I understand from people who knew her that she could be very acerbic and abrupt. But the underneath stuff, from where I looked at her, and I have to think about this as a biographer, I can't impose on her what I want her to be. Just her pure braininess is so attractive to me. And her courage and her willingness, she used to tell her students, and I tell this to my students, she used to tell her students, and I can sort of, they said she was always falling apart. The hairpins were always falling out of her hair, and her buttons weren't buttoned right. And sometimes, I mean, I've heard wonderful stories that her blouses were held together with safety pins. And she was a chain smoker, so there were ashes all over. And I had someone say at the Warburg who knew her that to watch Francis Yates try to manipulate the automatic coffee machine was just a sight to behold. And I just love this idea of a seemingly ditzy old lady who is so, so smart.
Well, I love that idea, too. But also, she said, quote, "I belong to no generation."
Yes.
What was she saying there, really?
Well, I think what she was saying, she was born in November 1899, and as she wrote very poetically, oh, God, she's a beautiful writer. I envy her writing. She said, "I was born on the cusp of the 19th to 20th century." I love that word. And this family that she was born to, her three older siblings were older by at least 10 years. And she was born into a deeply, deeply Victorian family. And I think, and again, I am so hesitant about putting words or thoughts into her mouth or head. I think she was more, at least I've put her that way in my book, more of a Victorian than she was a member of a citizen of the more comfortably a Victorian than she was a citizen of the 20th century. And then to just get savaged by these awful wars that she lived through. And I think to my mind, she is more a part of the Victorian tradition of women, independent women historians. So my sense is she felt out of place in her time. And that's how I interpret that remark.
Well, with the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, when she really, her popularity and the sale of those books, I think in one part of your book, she sold 400 of those books in a week. I've forgotten the correct quote. I can't quote it right now.
Yeah.
But that meant, she toured the planet. She came to the United States.
Twice.
Twice. And she came to Baltimore, and she spoke at Johns Hopkins.
Yes.
Do you know what her topic was?
No.
Because I don't.
And I've tried to find out. And for some reason, I'm sure I would guess we can, but I've contacted all these libraries when I was writing my book and asked. And some of them didn't even have, they suggested the school newspapers. And frankly, I didn't have the time or inclination to do that. So I was not able to find. She talked all through New England. She went to Chicago. But interestingly, I know we're running out of time, I thought with the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, the last summer of her life, as I discuss in my book, when she was 80, 81, she went to Budapest in a terrible heat wave. And she was tracking, I believe, that's why the Rosicrucian Enlightenment, which I think reads like a mystery novel. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's thrilling. She was tracking the Hermetic tradition onto the continent and deep into Central Europe. And I think that's where she might have gone had she lived longer in mm-hmm. her studies.
Yeah. Well, you note that it is a given that if Frances Yates had been born male in 1899,
yep.
her life would have been quite different.
No question. She would have been sent away to boarding school and Oxbridge and... Yeah, there's no question. And then I don't think she would have been the creative, imaginative scholar that she became.
So she would have been more comfortable, but her work and quality of her work, the depth of her work would certainly have been affected.
Yeah. A lot of women, as I write, focused on the Renaissance because they weren't traditionally trained. They usually didn't know Greek and Latin.
Mm-hmm.
And tended to know. She was fluent. She taught herself French and Italian.
Well, this has been a major joy to me. When I first saw your book in the catalog, Ibis's catalog, I just said, I can't believe this. This is amazing.
Because
I just could not think, there are too many people, except from my graduate school, but I don't bump into them that often,
right.
to talk about this. But there aren't too many people that really understand the importance of this soul and what she accomplished. And I believe her work is going to grow in understanding in the decades that come, because she was right. She wasn't of that generation. She may have thought of herself as a Victorian in some ways or other, but she was so far ahead of her time.
True.
that I believe that that when we do finally have women presidents and more women senators and more women this and that, and I think we'll be in much, much better shape because they seem to know how to nurture, they know how to care for, and they obviously do not want their sons going off to war. And we have, in this...
It's worse, it seems to me.
Yeah, you know, we have in this country a war economy, and we have whole party here that doesn't mind at all going to war whenever and if ever possible. And we've seen...
Anytime you want to talk about Francis, you know, that line, Alice Roosevelt's line, if you don't have anything good to say about someone, sit next to me. Anytime... Haven't you heard that?
Yeah,
my favorite lines.
I've forgotten more things than I possibly.
But anytime you want to talk about Francis Yates, sit next to me.
Okay, sweetheart, I'll do that.
Okay.
I'll come up to your class and just hang out in the back.
Sure.
Okay, dear?
Thanks.
Thank you, Marjorie Jones. Francis Yates in the Hermetic tradition. Ibis Press. Oh, what a wonderful name, Ibis Press. And, of course, you can order it from the front page of 21stCenturyRadio.com or visit Marjorie's page at MarjorieGJones.com. And coming up next, we interview filmmakers Skiz Cizik and Joe Tropia. I hope I got it. Tropia? Is that correct? Well, my producer doesn't know either, about their documentary in progress called Hit and Stay about the Catonsville Nine and the anti-war protest movement. See you in just a few minutes, and thank you very much, Marjorie.